Welcome to the Archive Room podcast, stories of Manx life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. Manx Radio. Fastamai, Judith Leigh here, once again opening the door to the Archive Room, Manx Radio's treasure chest of stories of island life from years gone by, told by the people who were there. So come on in, and let me take you for another gentle stroll down Manx Memory Lane. Well, Guys and Dolls is currently on the Gaiety stage, courtesy of Douglas Choral Union, and this year's Guild is just around the corner, and so I thought this would be a good moment to remember a few of the fascinating characters who, in their heyday, have made their own unique contribution to music and entertainment in general on the island. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to take your seats, please, the curtain is about to go up. And first on stage is Eva Kane, ably assisted by Master of Ceremonies, Mr. David Collister.
Looking at the Roy Hudd's Cavalcade of Variety Acts, and on page 92, under the letter K, it says Eva Kane, Siffleuse, Lady Whistler and Soprano, born Isle of Man 1923, and apart from a most melodious whistling routine of pop, she would then break into a coloratura vocal and usually stop the show. Her act was one of the first to be televised after the Second World War. Her family owned hotels on the Isle of Man, where, I believe, she retired. Well, she did, and here she is, and Eva Kane's with us. Eva, that brings back memories for you. That was from a very important TV show in your life, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was from Southport in the Flower Show week. And Dicky Afton, who was the producer of the show, had actually wanted me to do a special number. And he was telling us in Housedrake that he wanted something to be done specially for me from the Isle of Man. And Leslie Cerrone of the Two Leslies was there at the time. And of course, he wrote so many songs. And he wrote this for me in the lounge at Housedrake.
Well, of course, Leslie Cerrone is a very, very big name in show business, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
How did you persuade him to write the song for you, the Fairy Bridge song, then?
Didn't need any persuasion. Oh. He offered straight off. The strange part of it is that for all the songs and things that Leslie has written, he couldn't read a note of music and he couldn't play.
Really?
So we had to find somebody who would come and write it down as he sang it. And fortunately, Fred Callow came and he played it for us and wrote it down so that it could be orchestrated. Fred Callow, of course, was brother of Henry Callow.
Henry. Yes. You started off the programme here with the Fairy Bridge song, as we heard, and you were whistling there. Now, when did that whistling start? Because that was the main part of your act, really, was it?
Yes, it started when I was quite young, probably about 11 or 12. It actually started through Harriet Hart. She used to be our dance teacher with Doris Lothian, and she herself did a lot of whistling. And I tried it one day and found I could whistle and went on from there.
Can you remember your first stage appearance then?
My first stage appearance, I was only three. at the Gaiety. That was in the days when the Alwyn School of Dancing was going, and they did a show for the children, you know, rather like Christine Wilde does nowadays. And I was in that.
And then you went on to have a professional show business career, of course, didn't you?
Yes. I made my first professional appearance at the Palace Theatre when I was 8 with G.S. Melvin and Tom D. Newell in a sketch coming to the seaside where G.S. Melvin, who was a wonderful dame, was dressed as my mother. The other man was my father. And they pushed us on in the pram, and they had a little boy as well, a boy named Herbie Roberts. And there was quite a thing between Herbie Roberts and I, because he found out that I was getting 12 and sixpence a week and he was only getting 10 shillings a week. And he said, why did I get more money than he did? I said, because when they wanted two children for this sketch, they said they wanted a nice little girl and a horrid little boy.
Let's see if you remember this lady.
Has anybody here seen Kelly? Has anybody here seen Kelly? Find him if you can. He's a man as old as Antonio. Left me on my own, E.O. Has anybody here seen Kelly? Kelly from the Isle of Man.
Kelly from the Isle of Man.
Laurie Ford was a great friend of our family.
You've seen her singing that song, I suppose, a few times.
Oh, yes. It used to be wonderful at the Derby Castle, because she would come out in this magnificent dress and huge picture hats, and then she'd sing whichever song it was, and then she went off when the applause started. They played one chorus of the song that she had just sung, and she came straight back on, completely changed, to another wonderful gown and another big hat to sing the next song.
And you say that she became a friend of the family. You became quite intimately involved with her and other showbiz people, of course.
Oh, yes. You? She used to come up every night to Falconcliff.
But you've been involved with so many people in show business. I'm quite amazed at some of the names you've been telling me about.
Well, we go back a long time in our family. My father was in the theatre before me, of course, and my son follows on. So we're three generations of theatre folk.
All the big stars played at the Derby Castle, didn't they?
They did.
Was it always sort of quick-fire varieties, they called it?
Yes. And then, of course, they used to come over, some of the bigger stars used to come over for a Sunday night at the Palace, but that was more music, and then one big star, the likes of Alan Jones. Alan Jones came over for two or three times, and he always came up to stay with us. And one year when he found I was going for pantomime in Warrington, he offered to loan me his big trailer, which he had standing at Mere Golf Club. And he had it towed over to Warrington, and we lived in this tremendous caravan, which had never been seen like that over in these days. You know, it was all American things then.
And the Alan Jones that Eva Kane is talking about here is none other than the fine singer who is probably best remembered for one of his biggest commercial successes, the Donkey Serenade. But let's get on with our show, as David Collister asks Eva Kane about the Falconcliff Hotel. It was where Eva was born and grew up, and so it gave her ready access to lots of visiting celebrities.
Mentioning there the Falconcliff, that was the hotel, I suppose, that became the showbiz hotel on the island, did it?
Most of the stars stayed with us, yes. I was born there, of course. So this is how I got to know an awful lot of the show business people.
What a remarkable lady, sharing with David Collister such clear memories of the big music hall stars of the 1930s and 40s who could be found on stage on the island and staying at the Falconcliff Hotel, where Eva Kane grew up. But we're going now from music hall to music festival and joining Bernie Quayle to meet a very talented lady with strong links to our Manx Music Festival, the Guild. We're going back to the 1920s now to hear about Noah Moore, who competed successfully in the Guild a number of times with his Douglas Ladies Choir. He also sang in the Guild as a solo competitor. In the year 1914, he was one of the few Guild competitors who met with the approval of visiting adjudicator Sir Edward Elgar. In that same year, 1914, an 8-year-old girl was running around the household of Noah Moore. It was his daughter, Nora, and we join her now in the company of Bernie Quayle. Nora Moore was 86 when this conversation was recorded.
Nora, it must have been a wonderful experience growing up in such a musical household.
Oh, it was. It was lovely, because my mother had a lovely voice too, and my brother, he was musical. He could play the piano. He had lessons, of course, but he played by ear, mostly, and he played the violin, so I used to play the piano for him. There was always music in some form or other, pupils or someone coming or going. And then when my father became manager of Villa Marina, great artists were engaged for Sunday concerts, and we met them all, and it was all so interesting and a lovely concert. And when I look back now and think that the dearest seats were about 2 shillings, and now they're about £6 or something like that. He knew I had a voice, but he never wanted it to be forced, never believed in that. So I didn't have lessons. I went into the Guild once or twice as a young girl, but when I got to about 16, I think, or 17 it must have been, my father decided that I should compete for the Bourne Manx Scholarship, which you have to go to London for, and he taught me songs to sing, and I went to London, and I was awarded the Manx Scholarship, and I had 3 years tuition at the Royal Academy of Music. And curiously enough, I started learning with the man who had taught my father originally, Sir Edward Isles. So I was with him for a while, and he was interested in me, and that I could play the piano too. That was something they didn't always get. And I used to play for some of his pupils, and I used to do concerts with another pupil who sang in costume, and I used to play the spinet for her. Then, of course, I started having auditions for jobs. It wasn't easy. I had an audition for the Doyle Cart for the Sadler's Wells Opera, and I chose Sadler's Wells Opera. And I was there for quite a few years. And I was in the BBC in Leslie Woodgate's choir, and I had a wonderful experience there, most unheard of. We were practicing one day, and a message came through from a gramophone studio where Sir Thomas Beecham was rehearsing an opera, and his soprano, she was Italian, they were all Italian artists, she had taken ill, and he said, "Have you got a singer who can read Italian or speak Italian and can read music and could take this place and come to the rehearsal?" And he chose me. That was a thrill that I'd never forget. It was a wonderful rehearsal with all these Italians and Sir Thomas Beecham.
You recall some of the famous stars that appeared in the Villa Marina.
Peter Dawson I sang with, Paul Robeson.
Paul Robeson at the Villa?
Oh yes, Paul Robeson was twice at Villa Marina.
Nora, we looked a moment ago at your first major contract when you were with Sadler's Wells. That was 1933, but can you tell me that you spent a lot of time during the war years working with the Red Cross?
Yes, I did. I did what I could there. You get a sort of training, and you go out to the hospitals and help. But I sang to the troops, and I went to the sick and sang.
But during the war, you came back and you continued your service for the Red Cross here on the island.
Yes, I did. I came back, and I was in the Red Cross here, and I used to go to the hospitals here to the Majestic was the hospital that they had the men in here, and I very often went there, and when I was there I always sang. Lovely memories, yes.
Nora Moore, daughter of Noah Moore, sharing her memories of a lifetime in music with Bernie Quayle. The name of Douglas Buxton is legendary in the island's music world, and it all really started when he bumped into Noah Moore outside the Villa Marina one day. But let's add a little bit of background. Douglas Buxton was born into a musical family. He grew up in the early 1900s in a world of pierrots and seaside entertainment. Run by Dougie's father, Buxton's pierrot shows were a huge success. Then came the First World War and took it all away. Around 1919, Dougie's father became seriously ill, and despite the doctor's best efforts, he died. We join the story when Dougie is around 18 years old. The year is 1920, and Dougie and his sister Mildred are trying to restart Buxton's pierrot shows.
We did start the pierrots in Ramsey on 1920, and my sister Mildred, she was a soubrette in the show, and I was sort of front of the house manager. But that was a job for the summer, and I was at a loose end in the winters, and I happened to meet Noah Moore outside the villa talking, and he said, "Can you sing? Have you ever?" I said, "No, not since I was a lad." Well, he said, "Well, get the Gill song. Let's have a look at it, see what it's like." So I bought this song, Landon Ronald's Deep in the Heart of a Rose, it was called. Anyway, I got this song, and they put me into the Guild. And the adjudicator, I can't just think of his name, but he was a famous name. His father was a famous teacher and taught Lily Pons and all these great singers. And he was a teacher in London, and he was the adjudicator. He was quite a big class, there were about 20 in it, and he said to the audience, "You might be surprised, but I picked out a young man that I see great promise in." And he gave me the first prize, you see. And I was the youngest man in the class, so we were talking to him. I said, "Well, what do you think about taking music up as a career?" So Mother took me to Manchester, to the Royal Manchester College of Music, you see. Managed to get an interview. I took me one song and they accepted me as a student. So I burned my boats then. Little did I think what I'd putting myself in for. I hadn't had a wonderful education. As a lad, I wasn't very strong. When I was about 7 or 8, I had to be sent away to Heaner in Derbyshire. I had St. Vitus dance and all sorts of things, you know. So came back, and I started at a private school, Miss Green's in Derby Square. I was there for 2 or 3 years. Of course, the war came on, and we were tossed about from one place to another. We went to live in Heaner, and that's when I did a little bit of singing. But here I was going to be a professional singer. I'd never seen an opera in my life. I'd never been to hear an orchestra in my life. And my type of singing was more of the concert party style of singing, you see. So here I am. I'm going to start at college. I had to learn history of music, theory of music, counterpoint, harmony, languages, French, Italian, German, opera class, elocution. You name it, I had to do it, you see. It was just all absolute double dutch to me. The first opera I ever went to see in Manchester was Parsifal, of all operas. I mean, it's so advanced, you see. And I honestly couldn't make head nor tail of it. I thought, well, if this is what I put myself in for, heaven help me. And then the next one I saw was Peleus and Melisandre, which was just as bad. So anyway, the aim of all singers at a college, of course, is to become professional singers. After I'd been there a year or two, I started taking engagements and singing around the north of England. I got in with a Methodist group, and I did a number of Messiahs and Elijahs and Creations and things like that, and was doing quite nicely. My other brother was going to the Liverpool, starting at the Liverpool University, so I felt I had to come home and let him go to university, you see. So I came home, and that's how I started teaching, never thinking I was going to make a teacher at all. But anyway, I started in the Isle of Man doing a bit of teaching, and every Monday I went back to college and back again on the Wednesday and back home teaching, you see. Well, there were no planes in those days, of course. If I took a job in England, it meant 3 days. And in the end, it got that the singing was taking second place and teaching was becoming my forte, you see. One day, a little girl came to see me. She'd be about 16. And she said, "I'd like to learn singing." She says, "I've only got 2 guineas. She said, "So if it's any more than that," she says, "I can't come." So she came in and I heard her voice. She went in for the girls' solo and did quite nicely. At 18, I put her in for the open soprano and she won. She won the open soprano and then she went into the special soprano and on her second appearance, she won the special soprano and had to sing for the Cleveland Medal. And that year, it was held in the Palace Ballroom. And that night, the Palace Ballroom was packed. There must have been 7,000 people in it. And the adjudicator at the end of the competition said, "Now, I'd like to hear 2 of these singers again. The mezzo first, and then the soprano second." So Maggie Miney was the mezzo, and she sang. If she sang well the first time, by God, she sang well the second. And then the little soprano came on, and she was just 21. She came on and sang, and she won. And that was Mona Clucas, who eventually became my wife. She was the first one to ever win the medal at 21. So from then on, my name became quite well known, you see, as a teacher. I formed a school of music in Ramsey, in Parliament Street, and I had Miss Ridings used to take the violin, Doris Lothian used to take the dancing, Miss Ella Gale used to take the piano, and I used to take the singing, so we had a school of music in Ramsey. That went on very well, so then I started teaching in Peel. We were doing so well, I started being a bit ambitious, and I started taking people to Blackpool. You see, taking these soloists to Blackpool. And one day, on the Saturday, the choir competitions were on. So Mona and I roamed into the place where the big male voice choir was being held. And I was enraptured. Oh, I thought, this is glorious, all these male voices. When I got home, some time afterwards, I said, you know, I wouldn't mind starting a male voice choir. A number of my boys, like Archie Crellin and Norman Gacken and a number of them said, well, how about it? So I got the boys to all come down and I heard them all sing. I said, right, you sing top tenor, you sing baritone, you sing bass. And that's how we formed the choir, you see. We'd about 17 or 18 of them. So I said, how about I'm going to do it at the Guild, you see. So, right, we went in for the Guild. In those days, there were some good choirs in the Isle of Man. There was Wanderers were a fine choir, Noah Moore's choir, Ramsey, male voice, so we decided we'd go in and have a do, you see. I can always remember, we were on at the, I think it was the Gaiety Theatre at that time, and Noah's choir had just been singing, and they were coming down, and Noah was coming down the stage, down the steps, and I met Noah, and as my boys were coming, it was only 18 of them, and he said, "Where in God's name did you get that bunch from?" Anyway, we went on and sang. We were bottom, of course, but we weren't downhearted. Next year we went on and we were third. We beat Ramsey. And the third year, in 1940, we won the male voice and never looked back from then on. And that was the real beginning of the Londo Male Voice Choir.
And the Londo Male Voice Choir, founded by Douglas Buxton and now under the leadership of Julian Power, is still going strong and hopefully will be competing once again in this year's Guild. Bernie Quayle visited Dougie Buxton at his home to learn about the history of the choir. And I think that something Bernie saw there gives us a very fitting end to this conversation.
Displayed proudly on the walls of Dougie's home are numerous testimonies to a very long and very distinguished career in music in the Isle of Man. There are, of course, his 2 degrees from the Royal College of Music in Manchester, signed by Albert, who later became king. There's an illuminated scroll commemorating the 25th anniversary of the Londo, signed by the choir and the governor of the day, Sir Ronald Garvey. And the illuminated scroll from 1989, when he was made a Freeman of the Borough of Douglas for his long and distinguished service to the community and to music in the Isle of Man.
And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. I need to open the door and return you to the present day, but I do hope you can come back at the same time next week when I'll be taking another look at more fascinating and funny stories in the archive room. And ahead of next week's programme, here's a little teaser for you. Do you recognise this voice? Do you know who his father is? Be sure to join me next week to find out.
Eventually I would wander up onto Douglas Head, onto the fairground up there, and of course the people up there knew me and they would allow me to throw the mops at the tin cans, etc. Yeah. Without paying, because they knew me dad and they knew who I was. Mm. And he was a song plugger, basically. And he could play anything at all. He was a wonderful musician. Lawrence Wright, etc. You know, all the people in town, the music people, used to come to my father with new pieces of music and they would say, will you play this for us?
Yeah.
And he would plug it, of right. course, for a few bob. And that's how he earned his living. And
When he worked on the ferries then, how was he paid? Was he paid officially by the ferry owners or did he have to rely on the tips from the passengers?
Basically, it was the tips from the passengers. The ferry used to go across the headland, and while they were going over, the band used to play, and someone used to go around with a collection box.
Mm.
And that is, in fact, just the money that was used to pay the band and my father. That's all. There was no salary in those days. It was just, as you say, tips.
So he wasn't going to be earning a huge amount of money then, was he?
He did all right.
Don't forget, you can find all the programmes in previous series of The Archive Room by subscribing for free to The Archive Room podcast at manxradio.com or via your usual podcast provider. This is Judith saying thank you for listening and...
So long, yes sir.
Manx Radio.